then therefore, if he can look to the carrier for that, it could only be because he had some responsibility on his own part to make those payments. Otherwise, the carrier would not have any real obligation to reimburse him, I don't think. I could be wrong. This court does not have an easy task. The whole point of it is, this court is not the proper place to decide that the statute says the provider of service doesn't have a right to sue the person who gets those services. That ought to be done in the legislature, because there's nothing in the statute that uses the words exclusive remedy for the provider. The exclusiveness section of the workers' compensation statute, back at 8306, I believe, deals with the exclusiveness of remedies between the employee and the employer. And the whole parties, all the parties to a real workers' compensation claim are three. That's the employee, the employer, and the compensation carrier, who, because of a contract of insurance with the employer, has assumed certain responsibilities. But by assuming certain responsibilities towards an employer and an employee, the carrier cannot expressly relieve the employee of any responsibilities he might have to a third party or someone who isn't a party to that compensation contract. I could stand here, Your Honors, and I could espouse hypothets, and I'll not do that. I'll just re-urge the rule set forth in Satterwhite, that this court cannot properly or should not legislate what rights that a provider of services has under a statute if the statute is silent as to those rights. The proper forum is across the driveway in the Capitol. And that's where the Attorney General, and that's where the AFL-CIO, and that's where the Texas Municipal League, and that's where the insurance carriers, and that's where Mr. Smith ought to go, is across the street and try to get an amendment to the Texas workers' compensation statutes. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Counselor. Rebuttal argument from petition.
Your Honors, I would like to just briefly go down point by point and give my response to the various points made by respondent. The first being that I do not feel the argument about the 4.5-year wait in Harris County is relevant, if for no other reason than this, and that is that the statute, Section 7, Article 83 of Section 7, clearly states that the provider has an independent cause of action, trial de novo type thing, immediately after the board award. You can have a quick board award, and then the provider has an independent cause of action, which is not wiped out by the statutory scheme. It is expressly mentioned in Section 7. He can file his suit immediately. He does not have to wait until the whole thing matures and that sort of thing.
Counselor, we had a case in here earlier. You probably heard on the 20-day limitation period. Does the Act specifically make this doctor's or provider's cause of action conditional on giving notice of intent to appeal and filing the suit?
Your Honor, there is a set procedure set out, and I'm not sure, Your Honor, what the answer to your question is.
Counsel, I don't know when a doctor's cause of action would accrue in the event 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, finally it's decided not covered. If the rule is that a doctor can't sue, I don't know whether the cause accrued back when the services were provided or the earliest time that he could sue.
Immediately after the board awards, you know?
Yes. We held in an accounting case that a plaintiff didn't have a lawsuit until the Internal Revenue Service called on him to pay the deficiency. I don't know when they act, when the cause of action occurs.
I would imagine it would accrue. I'm not sure on that either. I would imagine...
But as the chief says, that's not before us.
It would accrue at the Board of War, but I could be mistaken.
Well, why wouldn't it accrue? Why wouldn't the doctor's common law action accrue after it's been decided by last court that there was no coverage?
That could very well be, Your Honor. I'm just not sure. I don't know that it's probably never come up directly. I would like to respond to the argument on the phrase in Section 7 and the injured worker. This was something keyed in on by the Court of Appeals and mentioned this morning in respondent's argument. My response to that is basically this. That phrase we submit in Article Section 7 is speaking of post-award type defenses. And furthermore, and again, this was where I was helped on amicus, I was not really aware of this, the attorney on the who had been the former member of the board pointed out that there's a lot of close call things. Does the carrier, is the association responsible for the TV, the color TV in the worker's room? Is it responsible when a chiropractor treats a patient for a burn? Is it responsible, a lot of these borderline type things, which basically the rule is, if it's really a true luxury, such as, for example, maybe a one-day stay in a hospital, color TV, the cost of the color TV, the worker is responsible for that, apart from any responsibility about the carrier. And it is that type of responsibility that statute is talking about when it says, and the injured worker. As far as the argument goes about the worker having to, nevertheless, still having the defense in the sworn account action about the reasonableness of the fee, our response to that is that that is not the time, that is not the forum, that is not the defendant's place to have to argue to a common law jury about the reasonableness of the fee. Typically, the worker is going to be pretty much on his own. He's going to be able to hire an attorney who probably does not have expertise necessarily in workers' compensation claims, particularly in jury-type situations. At the time, the whole idea of the workers' compensation statute is that the time when the worker is injured, when he's usually out of a job, or at least working at a lower level, is not the time when he can go to the courthouse and fight a lawsuit as a defendant on a suit on a sworn account. That is the time when the carrier, the association, is supposed to be his champion, so to speak. Sometimes, obviously, the carrier is often at cross purposes with workers. But the carrier here has always said, sue us. You're supposed to be suing us. You're not supposed to be suing the worker now. We're furthermore not talking about the problem of no right to sue ever at any time. We're talking about a right to sue as long as it's before the board, which it was in this case. I would like to respond briefly to the discussion on the Harleysville case because I believe it was misstated to this court. I do not think that it says you cannot sue the carrier, period. It said, in fact, you could sue the carrier. However, it was true that for the period of something like several days of treating the patient after the patient had reached a settlement approved by the board with the carrier, that extra time could not be recovered. But the case actually did allow the hospital and the doctor to sue the carrier. You can sue the carrier. It was true that it said that after a settlement approved by the board for those extra days, you could not recover. The hospital got all of its fees. The doctor got all the $28 that was for phone calls in the ensuing several days. The Beasley case, we feel that the main distinguishing factor about that goes back to Judge Greenhill's very first question this morning, and that was that the Beasley case was decided before the freedom of choice provision in 1973 came into the statute. And that is important because of this. That freedom of choice provision, in other words, the worker can choose its provider, says that the worker can choose its provider with the association being responsible. That type of provision, clear cut, was not in the statute at the time of the Beasley case. Also, side points, it was a late filing case. The claimant in our case has never recognized his obligation to pay. And the case also seems to hold that if the claim is for weekly compensation, benefit is barred, and also the medical is barred, which also is not necessarily true anymore. Finally, I would like to speak again as kind of a summary to the point about the statute not expressly stating that the provider may not sue the worker while the case is still before the board. It never has those words, but I have five things to say in response to that. First, it does set up a comprehensive scheme that includes things like saying that the carrier is liable, that the board is to regulate the fees and make sure that they're reasonable, which it only can do if it is allowed to make an award. Second, that scheme as a total scheme does expressly abrogate the worker's rights, common law rights, and so it puts him in a very deep, very serious bind. Third, the provider is protected because he still has his common law cause of action against, he still has his cause of action against the carrier and the trial de novo if there's abuse at the board. Fourth, the public policy of this state as touched on by the attorney for the Attorney General's office, including liberal construction of the workers' compensation statutes in favor of the worker because the worker is denied his common law rights. And also the very important policy of the state for quick medical aid, which the worker is only going to be able to encourage to attain if he does not have to fear that he's going to have to spend lawsuits about it, if he knows that indeed the carrier is the party responsible for his fees. Finally, the Satterfield case discussed by the Court of Appeals, we feel is not directly relevant simply because it's a host-guest situation, which is clearly distinguishable from this situation because, again, our point is we have a scheme that, as a scheme, does abrogate the common law cause of actions of the provider as long as the matter is still before the board. We say that the workers' compensation statutes relieve the worker patient from financial responsibility to fees and instead places it on the carrier, and that the carrier should have been the defendant here. The employee can't owe it at all. In the alternative, we say that the trial court still didn't have jurisdiction because the Industrial Accident Board never had the opportunity to make an award. In either event, this court should reverse the Court of Appeals and the County Court of Law of Brazos County and dismiss this cause of action. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written brief and oral argument for both parties. That concludes the oral
argument on the parties, their employees, servants, people of that nature. But our contention is that absent a clear, specific, unambiguous order directed at an individual to engage in a course of action or refrain from engaging in a course of action, then under the authority in ex parte Slavin and other authorities, he cannot be held in contempt for not doing so. The receivership orders of April 20 and April 24 impose no affirmative obligations upon the relator in this case. All of the affirmative duties are put on the receiver. During the course of litigation, or after the receivership orders had been entered by the trial court, the case was tried on the merits on May the 1st, 1981, at which time the district court, sitting without a jury, found in favor of Mr. Q. Subsequent to that time, the Game Peddler, Inc. filed its petition in bankruptcy under Chapter 11, and that portion of the case was remanded to the bankruptcy court. The receiver, immediately previous to the trial on the merits, had filed his first motion for contempt. That motion for contempt was deferred for hearing until trial on the merits could take place. The receiver then filed his second motion for contempt after the trial on the merits, at which time everyone was notified that the Game Peddler had filed a petition of bankruptcy, so that the hearing was again deferred. The receiver filed a third motion for contempt, which the relator responded to, pointing out certain deficiencies or defects in the show cause order, and no hearing was conducted on the third motion for contempt. Finally, the receiver filed his fourth motion for contempt, to which the relator responded again, setting forth the contention that we have urged before the court this morning. And on September the 28th of this year, relator was found to have been in contempt of court for violating the order of full receiver of April 20 and violating the amended receivership order of April 24, 1981. Subsequent to that time, he was incarcerated. We presented our petition for writ of habeas corpus,
and relator was released on bond pending this hearing. The final judgment in the trial on the merits expressly stated that the receivership order was to continue as a post-judgment ancillary proceeding. On August 26th, the trial court signed an order which it entitled or styled post-judgment receivership order and established cause number 8056661-A, which is the cause that the contempt hearing was conducted under and out of which the order of commitment arose. I insert that just for your information in the event some confusion arises with respect to the different cause numbers. We are here this morning on one basic contention, one basic proposition of law, that being that the relator's restraint is illegal by virtue of the fact that the order for receiver dated April 20 of 1981 and the amended order for receivership dated April 24, 1981 do not order the relator to do anything. Therefore, the relator cannot be held in contempt of those orders. In citing authority for the proposition that we are setting out to the court, we would direct the court's attention to the case of Ex parte Slavin, in which it was stated by this honorable court that it is an accepted rule of law that for a person to be held in contempt for disobeying a court decree, the decree must spell out the details of compliance in clear, specific, and unambiguous terms so that such person will readily know exactly what duties and obligations are placed upon him.
Well, now, Mr. Hodges was ordered to produce the books and records. Is that what he was ordered to do?
The court did not order him to do that. The receiver requested that he turn over the daily sales receipts and proceeds, that he perform an inventory, that he introduce the receiver to the various employees of the game company.
Did he not understand what he was to do?
Your Honor, there is evidence in the record that was adduced at the hearing on the fourth motion for contempt, where Mr. Hodges did expressly state that he was totally confused with respect to what he was to turn over in the form of daily receipts, daily sales proceeds, and it is our contention that it's by virtue of the fact that the orders in question required him to do nothing, that his confusion was created. And that is the reason that this honorable court has stated that to be enforceable by contempt, an order directing an individual to take some action must be clear, specific, and unambiguous. Since Mr. Hodges was not ordered to take any action, since it was the receiver who was ordered to take the action, it is improper for Mr. Hodges to be held in contempt.
You think if Mr. Hodges had been ordered to cooperate with the receiver, that he could be held in contempt for an order that just says that he's ordered to cooperate?
Your Honor, it is our position that had Mr. Hodges been issued an order directing him to do some specific action, that yes, he could be held in contempt for not complying with that order.
In other words, he'd have to be ordered to turn over specific things. He couldn't just be ordered to cooperate.
Well, we feel that it has to be a reasonable request. I appreciate the fact, relator appreciates the fact, that you can't go through an item-by-item basis of every possible action that the relator must take or refrain from taking, but that he should be put on some type of reasonable notice as to the general requirements of the order that he is going to be held in contempt of.
Should be some basis there, some outline, some parameters.
Precisely, Your Honor.
Well, help me again. He was ordered to turn over the books and records. Is that ambiguous?
The court not ordered him to do that.
Well, I'm just talking about what your argument that Slavin, you have to be specific.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Turn over books and records, is that ambiguous?
Your Honor, that statement in itself is not ambiguous. Mr. Hodges was not ordered to do that.
Turn over daily receipts? Is that what he was ordered to do?
He was not ordered to do that. Mr. Hodges was not ordered to do anything.
By anybody?
Except he was requested by the receiver.
Well, what I'm trying to do is slice it between who requested it and the specificness of the request.
Perhaps I can address your question in this manner. The two receivership orders did not require Mr. Hodges to do one thing. They did not require him to refrain from engaging in any type of course of action. They did not even mention his name. Subsequent to the entry of those orders, the receiver did go to Mr. Hodges and request that Mr. Hodges turn over the daily sales receipts, that he introduce them to the various employees and take an inventory. But the court did not order Mr. Hodges to do anything in his order of April 20 or its order of April 24.
Now, the receiver delivered two letters, I think, to Mr. Hodges, calling on Mr. Hodges to deliver the keys to the warehouse, to deliver all proceeds, to do that on a daily basis, to deliver all sums of money derived from the sale of inventory. Now, what I hear you arguing is that the relator was held in contempt not for violating any order of a court anywhere, but for violating, at most, the order of the court's receiver?
Well, Your Honor, it's our position that the order of commitment states that he is being held in contempt for violation of the order of April 20 and April 24. In effect, through, as I read the order, in effect, through a failure to comply with the request of the receiver. But he is specifically held in contempt of the orders of April 20th and April 24th. In the statement of facts that we have filed herein, I specifically pointed out to the judge, or I specifically spoke with the judge regarding that very point. And the judge answered me in the affirmative to the effect that yes, it was the order of April 20th and the order of April 24th that Mr. Hodges was then held in contempt of.
Well, the contempt order states that Mr. Hodges is president and chief operating officer, quote, deliberately obstructed and prevented the receiver from discharging his lawful duties. Would you address that?
Your Honor, I believe that in a continued reading of the text that it says that that obstruction and interference came about as a result of his failure to comply with the orders of April 20th and April 24th. That is my recollection of that order.
Well, it says, and refusing to permit the taking of a physical inventory. In other words, this is obstructing the receiver.
Your Honor, if to the extent that this honorable court wants to consider an obstruction of the receiver, I can appreciate that fact. I would go back to the original point that Mr. Hodges had never been ordered to conduct an inventory by the court. Only by request of the receiver.
He hadn't even been ordered to even cooperate, had he?
Your Honor, not directly to the receivership order. I would direct the court's attention to his holding in the case of Ex parte Padron, in which this honorable court held that to sentence one for confinement for contempt of a prior court order, that the order must be unequivocal in the form of a command. Additionally, in that opinion, it was stated that an individual cannot be held in contempt of an order that does not require him to do anything. In that specific case, it was a situation where a receiver had been appointed to sell the marital homestead of two parties to a divorce action. And the original receivership order, the receiver was granted certain rights with respect to transferring the property. Subsequently, a modified order was given with respect to the sale of the property, again directing the receiver to take certain action. Later on, the husband was found in contempt of court for violating the modified order based on his failure to sign certain documentation regarding the sale of the house. This honor of the court, and that opinion, sustained the relator's defense, or the husband's defense, to the effect that since neither of the receivership orders had ordered him to do anything, specifically to sign any documentation to effectuate the transfer of the property, that he had established a complete defense, to the contempt proceeding. Who would also direct this court's attention to the case of Stoner v. Thompson, which is a case that arises out of the First Court of Appeals in Houston, Texas, for the First District, where the Houston Court of Appeals held that an order was provided that a corporate owner of a radio station to be immediately entitled to inspect the books and records of the corporation was not enforceable by contempt against the general manager of that radio station, because the order did not define any duties upon the general manager, nor did the order set out any acts the general manager was refrained from doing.
Counsel, I'm familiar with those cases. I am a little bit concerned about the reach of those cases. I'm reading further in this contempt order. It says that the relator deliberately obstructed and prevented the receiver from discharging his lawful duties. Surely a court isn't helpless if any one of the broad public will come in and interfere with a receiver. Surely he isn't helpless against an interloper who comes in and interrupts the receiver and frustrates a lawful order.
If I might address that question, Judge, you will note that I did not sign that order, and I would point out that relator feels there is a great deal of self-serving language in the order with respect to the alleged contemptuous conduct of the relator. I believe that a reading of the statement of facts will show that the only conduct that the relator was guilty of was a refusal to comply with certain requests of the receiver, to the extent that those constitute an obstruction or an interference with the court. It's for this court to decide. But I would point out that it is the refusal of Mr. Hodges, the relator, to act that the receiver is complaining of, and it was his refusal to act that he was held in contempt for. Along those lines, with respect to a court being helpless, we say, of course, a court is not helpless, and that the proper procedure in a case such as the one at bar would have been for the receiver to go forward to the court that issued the receivership order, requesting an order specifically directing the relator to take some form of action or to refrain from taking some form of action. In that manner, the relator would then be put on notice of what he was required to do and could comply in that event. That did not happen here. There were two receivership orders issued directing the receiver to take certain action, not directing the relator to do anything. The relator was then found in contempt for violation of those two orders, which required him to do nothing.
No, he was found in contempt for frustrating the receiver, not for violating the order. As I read this order, maybe I'm not reading the right one.
Surely you wouldn't have us hold that a receiver has to go get a court order every time he wants to make somebody produce something that is within the purview of his responsibility and given him by the court.
No, Your Honor, we would submit that at the outset it would be the best procedure for the court establishing the receivership to point out what the respective individuals are supposed to do, at least for some reasonably great certainty.
How about a phrase in there that says, and I hereby order the world to cooperate with this procedure?
Your Honor, I would think that would be far too vague in individuals.
Would you have to name the specific individuals?
I think in a situation such as the case of Barr, where we have a relatively small corporation, that a direction to Mr. Hodges to specifically cooperate or to specifically take some action would not have been out of line at all. In fact, would have been the proper procedure. And to the extent that that did not come about in the original receivership order, then I feel that it would be proper for the receiver to go in seeking a specific order for Mr. Hodges to take some certain action so that he would have the clear, specific, and unambiguous order before him with which he could comply or not comply.
Counselor, would the same parties who drew the April 20th order, the April 24th order, motion for contempt also draw the order of contempt?
No, Your Honor. The receiver prepared the order of April 20th, 1981. the court amended receivership order of April 24, 1981. Then it was the receiver who prepared the order of contempt and for commitment with respect to the fourth motion for contempt. They were not the same people. The judge prepared his own order with respect to the amended receivership order. But the heart of our argument is going to the requirement that a clear, specific, unambiguous direction to the relator is required by the case law and by just the general doctrines of fair play and due process of law. At the hearing on the motion on the fourth motion for contempt, there was specific testimony given by the relator that he was confused, I finish his sentence, as to what was to have been turned over in terms of daily receipts and proceeds. That's in the statement of facts, and we believe that based on those, for those reasons, the relator should be discharged.
Thank you, Counselor. The court will take a brief recess.
May it please the court, I'm David Payton, Jr. of Ritchie & Greenberg in Houston, Texas, and I am the person who is the receiver below. I would like to call the court's attention to some very specific things involving the legal questions that are involved. I believe that my opponent, Mr. Westmore, accurately stated the facts as they occurred, and I'd like the court to focus on what I believe to be some very complex legal issues involved here. The principal problem that we deal with in this case is the fact that we have a corporation that is in financial difficulty, and the receiver appointed to take charge of some of those specific assets rather than the entire corporation. Of course, the corporation acts by and through its officers and employees, and for a corporation to take some action or to fail to do some action involves the human involvement of its officers. Now, in both the April 20 and April 24 orders issued by Judge Hughes, I had very specific duties. I was to take a physical inventory of the assets, the object being to find out what was actually in place in both the warehouse and in the various locations, so that we could determine how much actual physical inventory of these games was out there. We needed to determine the sales receipts so that we could make sure that the proceeds from those sales were to be deposited into the bank account, which I had set up, so that pursuant to the court's orders, a disbursement could be made, 30% into the registry of the court, and then 70% back to the game federal. The reason for this was that this is contained in the statement of facts that was filed this week. The reason for that is the game peddler's own bank account was continually operated in an overdrawn position, so that there was never a chance to seize funds actually in the bank account. Now, because I was ordered to do these certain things, it then becomes important to focus on what notice Mr. Hodges had in terms of what he knew that I was to do and what, in turn, he was supposed to do. Mr. Westmoreland cites to this honorable court several cases in which there was no specific order for a person to do anything. For example, in our own case, we mentioned the Britton case. There, a person who was in possession of rental property refused to turn over the rents to the receiver, and that person owning the property, possessing the property, was held in contempt. This court turned him loose because they felt that the use of a summary contempt proceeding was not the appropriate means to determine whether or not the receiver was entitled to receive the funds, implying that there must be some more expanded hearing, and I think the implication of that and the related cases, such as the Norton case, are that contempt would be appropriate only where the person who's in possession of the thing the receiver is trying to get is himself also a party. In this particular case, this is what we have, and this is what distinguishes those cases. Mr. Hodges was a party. He was present at the hearings. I personally made sure that he had notice of the orders issued by the court by handing them to him, and accompaniments with the letters that the court has has before you. And I would like to point out some very specific things that I asked him to do and at this point make some clarifications. Mr. Westmoreland argued that Mr. Hodges failed to take his own inventory and that I had requested him to take his own inventory. That's not entirely accurate. A close reading of my letter to Dan says that I, in effect, gave him his option. Either he could take his own inventory or give me access and I will do it with my employees. The orders issued by Judge Hughes empowered me to make Mr. Hodges' own employees my deputies or to go out and hire my own for the purpose of conducting this inventory. The problem came when Mr. Hodges refused to permit me access. He not only did not give me his employees, he refused to give me the keys to the locked warehouse.
Well, now, what statute is it that gives you authority, a receiver, not just you, a receiver authority to tell somebody to do something for the violation of which you'll be held in contempt?
I would agree with the court that I do not have power so extensive with the district court. I think the district court has the power to direct Mr. Hodges or anyone to turn specific property over to me. I, as the receiver, do not have the power to compel punishable by contempt Mr. Hodges to turn things over to me unless and except it is pursuant to a specific lawful order and done under the conduct and supervision of the district court, which is exactly what we have here.
Okay, why don't you just read what the district court told Game Peddler or Hodges to do?
Okay. If you carefully read the orders, what you'll find is that the orders direct me to take some 10 or 11 specific actions. But in each of the orders, the one to the effect that, for example, in paragraph 3 of the amended receivership order, the receiver is empowered to take possession of all persons, and now this does track statute giving receiver authority to do so, determined preliminarily by the court to be security for debts of the payer owing to Q, whether the property is in the possession of any party, their agents, employees, bailees, or trustees. Now, where we hang our hat is on this language here. This is the reason why I point out to the court the analogy to Rule 683, where the order gives me specific instructions, but by its own tenor is made binding upon the employees, of which, of course, Mr. Hodges was one, of the Game Peddler, and where he had notice of this particular requirement, then his failure to give me the keys, his failure to give me access, his failure to give me the daily receipts becomes deliberate obstruction. And that is the frustration which I personally felt as a receiver.
What is your authority for that statement he just made?
I'm sorry?
Your authority for saying that his failure to accede to your demands becomes deliberate obstruction of a receiver's act. What is your authority for that?
All right. Rather than holding out a specific case to you, I think that you have to take the entire body of the cases that we looked at to determine. If you look at the cases which have the third party holding, a non-party holding the assets, which say that you can't do it in contempt. I take it from a reading of those cases, say that where you, on the contrary, where you have a party who's in possession of those particular assets, then where he's acting contrary, where his action is such that it prevents the receiver from doing what he's supposed to do, then he is, and he has notice of the order, then he's deliberately obstructing the receiver.
Now, Counselor, you're telling us that although the cases say individually, the court must order an individual to do a specific act or not to do a specific act when he violates the order he's in contempt. And yet you're telling us that your authority, being a lawyer, is that you're going to ignore those individual cases, you go back to the general theory of receivership, and come in the back door, and that would be clear and unambiguous enough to hold a fellow in contempt for?
No, Justice Wallace, I think you misunderstand my argument. My argument is that, well, let's focus on Stoner versus Thompson, because I think that case stands as a roadblock to my being successful here. Let me take Stoner versus Thompson head on. In Stoner, Judge Hurd ordered that the corporation involved in that lawsuit should have immediate access to its own books and records for the purpose of allowing the bonding company to determine if the assets were there for their own requirements before issuing a bond. The general manager of that particular radio station, which is the principal asset of that corporation, refused, with knowledge of that order, to get access to the books and records, and Judge Hurd held him in contempt. On appeal to the Court of Civil Appeals, not this court, that court found that because the general manager was not ordered to do anything, then he could not be held in contempt. This court passed on that and refused a writ of reversible error. I think that looking at that case on its plain facts and applying it to the facts that we have here, there are some distinctions, but the distinctions are not great, and I will concede that. I think that the Stoner versus Thompson case causes the district courts, who the power receivers, to be in a situation where, as was suggested in the questioning to Mr. Westmoreland, the district court has to anticipate, when dealing with the corporation, every employee who has the ability to block a receiver taking possession or some inspector looking at the books and records, and specifically order each and every one of those employees to give access. For example, with Mr. Hodges' own corporation, he's not the only employee. If the district court had ordered Mr. Hodges to turn over the keys to me for the warehouse, but the keys happened to be in the possession of some secretary, and the secretary refused, then I would have to go back to court to get a specific order directing that secretary to give me.
Couldn't you have gone to Hodges and say, get the keys, and then you'd had him in contempt if you'd not done it?
But I'm still asking Mr. Hodges to do something that he himself is not capable of doing without getting somebody else to do something, if you see what I'm saying. And I don't know whether we could hold him in contempt for that or not. I would suspect that we could, but I haven't seen a case in point on that.
Well, if you asked him to turn over the keys and he didn't do it, then he would, in order to keep himself from being in contempt, he would have to show the impossibility of it, that the keys were not in existence, not that his secretary had them, because he could get them from the secretary. And the failure to turn them over to you then, I think you would be in contempt.
All right.
Because it was possible for him to perform.
I think that may be a correct analysis. But the problem that we're faced with here is where I am ordered to take an inventory. And the Court of Civil Appeals order and the first order and the second order by Judge Hughes all ordered me to take an inventory. Take an inventory of the property in place, not to move it somewhere else and do it. Where Mr. Hodges is the person who had, as the record shows here, is the one who has possession of the keys. And as the statement of fact shows, he never himself was willing to give me permission or access to come in and take that inventory, where he knows I'm supposed to, where he denies me the access, then why is that not just the sort of obstruction that Judge Hughes could find the man in contempt for? I think that is exactly what we have here. I think that Judge Hughes...